All right, good afternoon. It is Thursday afternoon, February 18th, 12:45 now. We've been talking for about 5 minutes, just checking in, seeing how everybody's doing, checking that the communication is all working appropriately. The plan for today is to move on from the synthesis chapter, move into chapter 13, move into alcohols and phenols. And we'll do a little bit more work this afternoon in the lab where we'll do some more synthesis problems. So I have some more things that I did this morning that I worked with the morning group. I'll do those same things with the afternoon group. And I think that will give you more of the practice that you're looking for within the synthesis component. In a lecture, I'd like to try to keep it moving a little bit. So let me start a screen share. If I can find it, there we go. Start this up. I'm excited for you guys to see this next video segment that I put together too for lab, because I'm branching out. I'm trying to learn some new skills and some new things. So I did some animations for this video, and we'll see how these animations come out. I'm either going to be successful or I'm going to waste just a shit ton of time. One or the other. I don't know what it's going to be. We'll see. All right, because his animations just sucked up time. Chapter 13, alcohols and phenols. All right. Within this chapter, first thing, many of the alcohols have common names. And so you can get into certain types of structures that are terpenes and diterpenes, and they'll have big complex structures. And then they'll have these nice, simple sort of names, like geraniol. it's the odor component that you find in roses and geraniums. And so, sometimes many of these compounds have common names. But we're going to learn, instead of their common names, we're going to focus more on the systematic names. So I just wanted to give you just a couple of different ones. This one is grandisol. Grandisol is a pheromone from the male boll weevil. Okay, so let's do a little thing on nomenclature real quick. So as we start nomenclature of alcohols, the parent chain must contain the hydroxyl group. Hydroxyls can be substituents, but if we're naming it as an alcohol, then the alcohol must be part of the parent chain. Hydroxyl should always receive the lowest possible number. So when we're numbering them, so I'm looking at the example that I've got here. If we're going to number this out, the proper numbering system would be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 going down the alkene. And we prioritize the hydroxyl over the alkenes and the alkynes. So they get the lowest possible number. So if we're numbering this out, we've got two substituents, we've got two methyl groups, We have a 4,5-dimethyl. And then we have a 5-ene, the location of the double bond. We have a 2-all. We've got 6 carbons. And so we put all that together. And as we assemble it, we get 4,5-dimethyl. Hex. And then at this part, we use the locator numbers 5-ene, 2-all. And that would be how we would break down the name. Okay, so we can include multiple functional groups. We still alphabetize and prioritize all the way that we have been doing. It's just that that alcohol takes the last priority, or is the highest priority. It becomes the last group mentioned in the name that tells it that this is an alcohol, and it should get the lowest possible number for where that alcohol resides. Okay. And this one I've left off. If you look carefully, you'll notice that this one actually is a stereocenter. There's actually more than one stereocenter here. There's 2 stereocenters in this molecule. I didn't list them by stereochemistry. I didn't give you stereochemistry. So we leave that part off if we're just naming it simply that way. For some of the alcohols, there are alcohols that just have common names that we refer to. So some of the common names are things like isopropanol, or tertiary butanol. Or benzyl alcohol. So we'll see some of those as well. Okay, some of the things that we're gonna go through, I'm gonna go through a little bit faster because some of these are gonna be review as I start going into some of these. Classification. When we look at an alcohol, alcohols can be primary, they can be secondary, or they can be tertiary. And they follow along with the same way that we think about carbons. So a primary carbon, which is attached to one other carbon, we have an alcohol that is on a primary carbon, secondary carbon, secondary alcohol, tertiary carbon, tertiary alcohol. So the way that we refer to those by classification, primary, secondary, and tertiary. Phenols are a special class. When we look at phenols, we need to be a little bit careful in the way that we pronounce things. For instance, when we look at an aromatic ring as a substituent, do you know what we call the substituent?
Phenol.
Phenol, which if you're not careful, in your pronunciation, the phenol, the YL and the OL can be confused. And so when you're talking about a phenol, sometimes you exaggerate that end name, that all name to distinguish it from a phenol, just to be clear and careful of the way that we pronounce those two different things and the way that they're sounding very similar. The phenols have, phenols have different acid-base properties from the alcohols. I'm going to hit those acidities in a second. Maybe before I hit acidities, let's hit some other physical properties, and then I'll hit acidities. If we take a formula that is C2H6O and we look at two corresponding molecules, this is dimethyl ether and ethanol. They each have the same molecular formula. They're isomers. But when we look at their boiling points, dimethyl ether has a boiling point of minus 24 degrees Celsius, and ethanol is 78 degrees Celsius, vastly different. And so dimethyl ether is a gas at room temperature. How do we explain the differences in the boiling points of these materials? Why is ethanol have such a higher, H bonding. Okay, excellent. Drew, JC, Lindsay, perfect. Okay, so the dimethyl ether has a dipole moment and it's polar, but it only has dipole-dipole in terms of its IMF or intermolecular attractive forces. But the ethanol can do hydrogen bonding. And so that's one of the main things that we think about when we look at alcohols to realize is that we get very strong partial positives on the hydroxyl and strong partial minuses on the oxygen, which allows for hydrogen bonding. And that hydrogen bonding is a much stronger intermolecular attractive force than is dipole-dipole, which results in the higher boiling point. So all of these things are things that are pretty much review. Also, in terms of water solubility, when we look at an alcohol, the hydroxyl group, I think of as sort of like a polar head on the molecule. And it has the ability to solubilize three to four carbons, let's say up to four carbons. And so basically what I think about when I think about an alcohol is that the alcohol acts kind of like a truck and trailer in its ability to hydrogen bond with other water molecules. That's not hydrogen bonding. I need the hydrogen there. And its ability to hydrogen bond usually means that it can cart in three to four carbons into water with it. And that's opposed to something that if we make it ionic, for instance, if we go with an O minus, that this type of ion is a much better thing that when we have something which is ionic, it can drag in 30 to 40 carbons into water. So I often talk about just for solubility, water solubility is something to bring up every time we look at new functional groups, that hydroxyl groups bring in a limited number of carbons for water solubility. They don't make things very water soluble, even though it's very water-like to have that hydroxyl group, only three to four carbons per hydroxyl. So that means if you have two hydroxyls, you can drag in somewhere between six and eight carbons, depending on the structure. When you go to a carboxylic acid, it's seven to eight carbons for every carboxylic acid. When you go to something that's ionic, all of a sudden it's like 30 to 40 carbons that can be dragged into water for water solubility. So just a little note on how polar that functional group is. Okay, acidity is where we start to get into some interesting concepts. When we look at the acidity, we have, we've done this before, carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, hydrogen, oxygen, hydrogen, halogen, that the pKa's of these types of protons, depending upon structure, 45 to 60, 35 to 45, this is 15 to 18, and somewhere between minus 10 and 3, depending upon the type of halogen that we're looking at. And so relative to carbons and nitrogens, the proton is fairly acidic.
Jason, if
yeah.
Your screen froze.
One more time. I'm sorry, I didn't quite hear.
I think your screen froze. I'm not sure if I'm the only one.
Yep, frozen. Thank you. I don't know why that happens periodically. Sometimes I go an entire lecture or three lectures without it freezing. And then once in a while, it just decides to crap out. There we go.
I have the app and it happens all the time too.
Yeah, it's just glitzy. It's a little glitzy. And I don't know if it's on the iPad side or if it's on the Zoom side. I have to assume that it's on the Zoom side and the connection. Okay, so the proton is fairly acidic, and this just has to do with the fact that we have dipole moments where we're very small dipole moments based on the electronegativity of the carbon, and that we increase in partial minus and partial positive hugely as we go forward. And it's just the trend in electronegativity and increasing electronegativity. As we go across that table, electronegativity on carbon is 2.5, nitrogen is 3.0, oxygen is 3.5. And if we go to fluorine, fluorine is 4.0, and hydrogen is 2.55 for reference. No, 2.35 is hydrogen. Okay, so for deprotonation, it is going to be one of the reactions that we're going to look at a lot is using oxygens as nucleophiles. And if you're going to use oxygen as a nucleophile, then that means that you want the oxygen to actually have a negative charge. So how do we deprotonate these reagents for deprotonation? So these are reagents that are making oxygen nucleophiles. Hydrides. These are things like sodium hydride, potassium hydride, calcium hydride. Different hydride reagents, metal hydrides. In this case, we react the metal with a hydride. Have we talked about hydrides? Have you guys know what a hydride is? Ooh, okay. Maybe we don't even know what a hydride is yet. Let me move this down. What do we call this? H plus. What's the name of that?
Proton.
It's a proton. Why do we call it a proton? Because it's positive. you call it a proton. Where does that name come from? If we look at hydrogen, this is a hydrogen atom. And it has one proton and it has one electron. And that's the hydrogen atom. when you look at the proton H plus, which we refer to as a hydrogen ion, or we just call it the proton, it has one proton, but it has zero electrons. Essentially, all it is a proton. And so that's why we give it that name. So we either call it the hydrogen ion or we call it a proton because that's simply all that's there. Okay, what is a hydride? Hydride is an H minus. It has one proton and it has two electrons. Essentially, it is a hydrogen that has a lone pair. And just like anything that has a lone pair, when we talk about O2 minus, or we talk about N3 minus, or F minus, all of these things that have negative charges, we refer to it as oxide, nitride, fluoride. And when it's H minus, it's hydride. The nomenclature is that the IDE ending refers to an atomic anion, an element that is the anion. And so each of these with a negative charge end in IDE, and hydride is no different. So hydride is just a hydrogen that has two electrons, and as such, it functions as a base. And so I have the two electrons. That's the hydride. The electrons grab the proton, kick the electrons back to the oxygen, and you now have O minus, and you have made hydrogen gas that leaves the reaction vessel and bubbles out of the reaction. And the counter ion is the sodium. So we'll move that over. We'll make room for our sodium cation. So hydrides deprotonate things very cleanly because there is no residue. There is no other thing that I need to remove out of the solution once the reaction is done. The gas just leaves the reaction vessel and there's nothing to isolate or clean up after using this as a base. The other base that we frequently see is the use of alkali metals for the same reason, because alkali metals can deprotonate alcohols very cleanly. So we simply throw in sodium metal. So our alkali metals are sodium, potassium, lithium. These metals in their elemental state react in a free radical reaction that creates the cation for the sodium and also hydrogen gas. And I wasn't going to do the entire mechanism out on that one, but essentially what it does is it gives up its electron to the hydrogen, creating hydride. That hydride pulls another hydrogen, which creates the H2, and the sodium then is the counterion for the alcohol. So you've seen this reaction, most likely, if you took chemistry with Josh, or actually any of the Chem 1A instructors. Sarah would do it too, I would imagine, would be to throw sodium metal into water. And you've ever seen that sodium metal into water and it ignites, it sparks, it jumps around, and it bubbles a lot. And the bubbling that you're seeing is the release of hydrogen gas as it's bubbling. And oftentimes, if they throw in too big a chunk, that hydrogen gas can detonate, causing small explosions. Josh has blown up many fish tanks that way. I've lost two of my favorite fish tanks to Josh and his sodium demos. But that is the way it goes. Okay, so there are many other bases. These are two of the favorite bases, hydrides, metal hydrides, and alkaline metals are two of the favorite ways to deprotonate them. Okay, and then when we start correlating structure with pKa and looking at the acidity, we find that those that are fairly sterically hindered types of alcohols, these guys have a pKa right around 18. normal primary alcohol has a pKa right around 16. 15.7 is what we often quote. So we're kind of rounding it up here just to 2 sig figs. However, we can change the acidity by taking and putting on electron withdrawing groups. So if we take and we throw in 3 chlorine groups and we use some strong electron withdrawing groups, we can get that pKa to drop down to like 12.2. That just stabilizes the anion, making the anion more stable. And if the anion is more stable, then the conjugate acid is more acidic. And then I was going to put phenols in here. So I'm trying to move everything over a little bit to make room for my phenol. Phenols are different in that their pKa's are in the 10 range. Nine and 10. And just as this one was electron withdrawing groups that stabilized it, this one is stabilized by resonance. And so the phenol, we think of it is a type of alcohol, but it's very different than normal alcohols. And it has different types of chemical reactivity because of its greater acidity. So these are much more acidic than a standard alcohol. Okay. A bunch of synthesis components. These are all review. So one of the things that we learned was that if we had a leaving group, and we reacted this with sodium hydroxide, and we did this fairly cold, that because this is in a primary position in a good nucleophile, this is one way in which we can make alcohols. Heat this up too high and you start to get elimination. If we have a tertiary position, and we have some sort of leaving group, and we treat this with water, a little bit of heat, we can undergo an SN1 reaction, which would go through the carbocation, and we can create alcohols. So just a couple of different ways to be able to make alcohols. And then in addition to these, we had several reactions from alkenes. Where we can take and hydrate. So these are hydrations. Ultimately, they lead to hydrations, but like this one, we could do oxymercuration, demercuration. With water as our nucleophile. And then you have to use the sodium borohydride to get rid of the mercury. And lastly, we could take and we could do BH3THF. And then the oxidation step. And that turns our reactivity around. And so we have all these different ways of producing alcohols. Some notes on the first hydration here. this forms a carbocation. And so you need to watch out for hydride and alkyl transfers. Shifts. The mercury acetate one does not go through carbocation, has no shifts. And the boron one is directed by electronics. So those are all the ways that we had of making alcohols. So we've covered sort of our SN2, we've covered our SN1, we've covered reactions from alkenes. There weren't any ways of making alcohols from alkynes, because every time we made an alcohol from an alkyne, we ended up with an enol, and that enol tautomerized. So there was no alcohols that were derived directly from the alkynes. That's all the review stuff. Now we launch into some new ideas. So I know I was going a little bit quick through that. Now we'll slow down a little bit as we start to read some of these new concepts and new ideas. Just kind of wanted to get all of those into the record. All right, we're going to start looking at reductions. So in a reduction, what we do is we take a carbonyl and we reduce it. And we're going to use a symbol, just an H in square brackets, to represent reduction. And what we have essentially done is we've essentially added hydrogen across the bond, much in the same way that we would take a double bond and we would hydrogenate it with hydrogen and palladium or platinum. And we would add that hydrogen across the bond. It's the exact same reaction, only now what you have is an oxygen that hydrogen is being added across. And there are different metals which will do this reaction, but it's the exact same thing. We're taking and we're adding in hydrogen across the bond. And the reaction mechanism is almost identical, at least with the metals like this. There are other ways that we can look at doing the hydrogenations, but they are essentially the same reaction that we're looking at in terms of reducing. And so when we start looking at reducing these things, it's always good to look at oxidation states. And have an idea in our minds of the different major sort of oxidation states that molecules can have. So if we just look at one carbon and we look at the sequence of adding oxygen to a molecule, that when we go in this direction, these are oxidations. And so I'm oxidizing each one of these molecules in stages sequentially. And I start, this should be CH4. And I start from methane and I make methanol. From methanol, if I oxidize it further, I make formaldehyde. If I oxidize that further, I make formic acid, and anymore I make carbon dioxide. Methane, methanol, formaldehyde, formic acid, and carbon dioxide. Oxidation states on each one of these. Carbon is in a minus four oxidation state in methane. It's in a minus two in methanol. It's in a zero oxidation state in formaldehyde. It's in a plus two state in formic acid and a plus four state in the carbon dioxide. So remember that oxidation number, the sum of all of the oxidation numbers needs to add up to zero for a molecule. And so basically what we're taking is the rules that say that oxygen is always minus two and hydrogen is always plus one. And so when we take up all of the elements, if we take, there's four positive charges, that means that carbon must be minus four to balance it out. There is one minus two, and there are four, there are four that are positive one. So if you take minus two and plus four, we're at plus two, that means carbon must match it at minus two. Minus two, and each hydrogen is plus one, so that comes out to zero. Carbon must match that, so it comes out to zero. Minus two, minus four, and then plus one, but I have the other three hydrogens that are over here. And so you take those other three hydrogens and the net charge from the oxygens comes out to a minus two, so carbon balances that at plus two. And then here in the last one, minus two, minus two, and carbon has to balance that at plus four. So we have all the oxidation numbers and the oxidation states there. Going the other direction, if I go this direction, this is reduction. And I can sequentially reduce each one of these molecules and go back the other direction if I want. So we usually think of oxidation, the symbol, oxidation, in organic sense, we say this is the gain of oxygen. Or loss of hydrogen. And that's what an oxidation is. In reality, oxidation is really the changing of an oxidation state where we go to a higher oxidation number. It's the oxidation is the loss of electrons. So the actual rule that we use is loss of electrons. But in an organic sense, that loss of electrons corresponds to the gain of an oxygen atom or the loss of hydrogen. And reduction is the opposite. Reduction is the gain of hydrogen. Or loss of oxygen. So it's easier to track the hydrogen and the oxygen in tracking oxidation states with organic molecules than it is to sit down and figure out whether it's gaining or losing electrons. But the same rules apply. We're not changing anything. We're just looking at older sort of definitions of oxidation and reduction. And why does that become important? Because we're going to look at reducing agents. And this is a new way to form alcohols from carbonyl compounds. So we can take a carbonyl and we can reduce it with hydrogen in the presence of metals like platinum or palladium or nickel. There are many others that will cause this reaction to take place. It requires higher temperatures. than alkenes. But essentially, it is the same reaction. And that means because it requires higher temperatures that it is possible to take a molecule that has a double bond in it and an alkene and to treat it with platinum at a lower temperature, say 25 degrees C. To be able to keep the carbonyl and then to increase the temperature, if you so desired, at something like around 100 degrees C, and you can reduce it down to the alcohol. So it can be selective because of that temperature difference. Usually when you see people doing hydrogenations of a double bond, it never touches the carbonyl. But if you want to, you can make it reduce the carbonyl. You just need to heat it up higher. And oftentimes we use higher pressures as well. So we'll use elevated temperatures and pressures in order to effectively reduce the carbonyls down. That's sort of a hard reaction to do because of the higher temp and higher pressure. There are easier ways to accomplish these reductions. And so we look at hydride agents. So hydrides, are simpler to use. Sodium hydride, sodium borohydride, BH4, or lithium aluminum hydride can each reduce this down to the alcohol very simply, very easily. And when we look at these, sodium borohydride is the weaker of the two reagents. This is a weak reducing agent. I don't know how much Zaruba talked to you guys about the boron hydrogen bond. But the electronegativity between boron and hydrogen is such that the hydride gets partial minus and the boron gets partial positive in the bond polarity. And so this guy acts as a hydride. That's different than the carbon-hydrogen bond polarity, where hydrogen is partial positive and carbon is partial minus. It has a reverse sort of polarity. And so that hydride can come off. And also there's another thing, and that is that boron, where do I do this? I need space. Let's do it here. Boron is in group 3A. You guys remember that? You remember what the group numbers relate to? What it means to be in group 3A? I know I'm asking you to stretch back all the way to three valence electrons. Yeah, exactly, JC, nice, thank you. Stretching all the way back to chem 3 and chem 1A and chem 1B, it has three valence electrons. So boron, what boron likes to do is boron likes to make only three bonds. But when boron makes three bonds, it's trigonal planar and it has an empty p orbital and it's isoelectronic with carbocation, with C+. It's sp2 hybridized. Isoelectronic means that it has the same electronic configuration as a carbocation. But when you look at it, it only had the three valence electrons. It is making three bonds because that's the best it can do. It's neutral, but it's lacking an octet. So there's no octet right now. Six valence electrons. Broken octet. And yet that's all boron can do because boron comes with three valence electrons. Now, if boron binds to a fourth thing, say four hydrogens, the boron gets a formal negative charge. So that's its formal charge. It now has an octet. So it satisfied the octet rule, but it's got the negative formal charge. And so it goes back and forth between these states in a schizophrenic sort of way because it wants the octet, but it doesn't want the formal charge. And so these two energy states between being tetrahedral and being trigonal planar, boron goes back and forth between these two states easily, which makes boron an amazing catalyst for a lot of different jobs. When you have something that is stuck between two states and can't figure out what it wants to be, those are awesome catalysts and they do all kinds of catalytic activity. With this, with boron lets go of the hydrogen as a hydride in a way to fall back to this more basic state, more like its elemental state that it should be in without a formal charge. So the way in which that works is when we have a ketone, we have partial minus and partial positive. The hydrogen from the boron has a partial minus charge on it. And it transfers with its electrons to that electrophilic site, to the carbon at the base of the carbonyl. That breaks a bond, moving the electrons up. That usually generates the O minus. We have added in the hydrogen. The boron goes back to being now trigonal planar. And what typically happens is that the boron binds to the oxygen, and in binding to the oxygen becomes tetrahedral again. And now that it's picked up that oxygen, and become tetrahedral again, and now has a formal negative charge on it, it's ready to distribute another hydride. And so it will continue in this fashion, giving up hydrides until it has no more hydrides left. And the boron is then bound to three of these guys. Four of these guys, actually. Take that back. These then, usually, either through water or something like methanol. Methanol is commonly used as a proton source. The boron will swap out each one of these groups and they will get protonated. And the boron will end up as OH4 borate. And that's the final state, which is water soluble and able to remove out of the reaction solution. So typically what you see done is when you want to reduce a carbonyl, the carbonyl is typically reduced using sodium borohydride in methanol. as the solvent. And you say, well, wait a minute. Methanol has a protic hydrogen. And if boron has a hydride and there's a protic hydrogen, what about this reaction? And the answer is absolutely. This happens. And so when you put sodium borohydride into methanol, it does bubble like champagne. You'll see little tiny bubbles coming out, but it happens very slowly. And it happens slowly because boron is a weak hydride. And because the electronegativity difference between boron and hydrogen is not that big, that changes when we look at something like lithium aluminum hydride. So lithium aluminum hydride is a whole different animal. Here, what we're looking at is an aluminum that is tetrahedral and negatively charged, and the lithium is the counterion. And these guys have a big fat partial minus, and on the aluminum, a big fat partial positive. And I know that that throws people that, wait, the aluminum has a formal negative charge and yet carries a partial positive? Yes, because the polarity of the bond is such that the aluminum does have a formal negative, but the polarity of the bond is that the hydrogen carries much of that negative charge because of the polarity difference. And because this is so polar and such a strong partial negative, this thing explodes in air. You expose it to air and it turns into a giant green fireball. You drop the bottle, you can't run fast enough, it detonates. The syringe needle breaks. You need to find some place to get rid of the syringe fast because fire just comes out of the tip of the syringe and there's no way to control it. Lithium aluminum hydride is a very strong reducing agent. And it reduces all sorts of functional groups. It reduces aldehydes, ketones, esters, carboxylic acids. It reduces all kinds of things. So number one, no protic solvents. Because it will explode with protic solvents. Must use ether solvents like THF. This reduces all sorts of functional groups. It reduces aldehydes, ketones, esters, carboxylic acids, amides, nitriles, it reduces all kinds of things. Whereas, and I don't think I wrote this, under sodium borohydride being weak only reduces aldehydes and ketones. It doesn't reduce anything else. So if I do sort of a comparison here, sodium borohydride, lithium aluminum hydride, and lithium aluminum hydride is often referred to as LAH. This is weak. Protic solvents okay. Reduces Aldehydes and ketones. Can be handled in air, easy to work with. Still dangerous. Our lab tech at Cabrillo, we had used sodium borohydride and I didn't caution her well enough, I guess. I didn't really think about it. Some students had used sodium borohydride in one of our chromatography reagents reactions, and the sodium borohydride had spilled by the balance. And without gloves on, it just looks like a powder, and it's just a powder like any other solid. And she went and she swept it up with her hands really quick. And the hydride burned her hands. She had white marks on her hands where the hydride contacted her hands, because the hydride actually transferred to the hydroxyl groups on her skin, created strong alkaline, and she got base burns on her hands in the places where she touched it. So we oftentimes forget that while sodium borohydride is weak, we use that in the sense that lithium aluminum hydride explodes in air. And so anything that doesn't explode in air seems fairly safe and easy to handle. And so that's our reference point. But just because something doesn't explode in air doesn't mean that it's not reactive and dangerous and needs to be given its proper respect. So LAH is strong. It's hard to handle. No protic solvents. Reduces everything. So many groups, it can reduce the aldehydes and the ketones, the carboxylic acids, the esters, nitriles, amides. Let's do amides. So amides are in there, hard to work with. Must be protected from air. So those are sort of our differences. And this is a continuum where there are many hydride reagents that are in between. Okay, JC, sodium borohydride will still work even in an aprotic solvent too. Yes, it will. We typically use it in protic solvents because it's easy to use in protic solvents, and aprotic solvents don't solubilize ionic things very well. So when you switch to an ionic, or when you switch to an aprotic solvent, you really need something that is like THF that can solvate ions and do that job. For that reason, we tend to use it in methanol or ethanol as a protic solvent based reagent, but it will absolutely work in absence of that. Yes. And there are many hydride reagents. Between these of intermediate strength that do different jobs that we're not going to look at. Okay, so one difference in the way that we look at these reagents, if we do the reduction with sodium borohydride in methanol, we make the alcohol. In the other one, it requires two steps to make the alcohol. The two steps are, because there's no protic solvents that you can use, you must use the lithium aluminum hydride and then some dilute acid. And that's to protonate at the end. Okay. So that's the difference between the two. So that means that we have some options now. Our options are that if we want to take a material, that has a ketone and an alkene, and we want to treat this with different reagents, we could do sodium borohydride in methanol. We could do LAH in THF, and then dilute acid. Or we could do hydrogenation with platinum, and let's do, instead of parentheses, let's center that at high heat and high pressure. And so in the first one, with sodium borohydride, the most mild of these reducing agents, we reduce only the alcohol, or only the ketone to the alcohol. The lithium aluminum hydride would do the same. The high pressure and heat would reduce both things. And I guess I could put a fourth one in here, which is H2 platinum room temperature. And I can reduce down the double bond without reducing the ketone. And so we have some variability in the way that we can do different reactions. Okay, a little bit more on selectivity. Let's do a couple of other selectivity things. I know I was writing fast, so I'm giving you a second here, making sure everybody's caught up. Even though I'm not copying and pasting, I know I can go quick. Will this be on quiz 3 or just stuff from earlier? I'm not sure what you mean. Quiz 3 doesn't have any, so quiz 3 should be just the earlier stuff. None of this is on quiz 3. Quiz 3 is just on synthesis things that we're already covering, or that we have already covered. So none of what I've started today is on quiz 3.
Do you by any chance have a star chart of the alcohol reactions?
Not yet. We will. We'll make one. The hard part with this is that you have to think about it that we're kind of doing an inverse star chart. Right now, we're looking at ways that we can make alcohols. Then we're going to turn around and we'll look at ways that we can use alcohols. So when I've been doing the star charts, one of the things that I've been doing, if you look at the couple of star charts that I put up, is that I always have an arrow that is sort of in that tells me how to make that material, and then all of my star charts that go out away from that. So I can envision the same sort of thing where we can take some of these materials that we're looking at that we can make alcohols from, have them be at the top of the star chart, and then some bridges out of what we can do with those alcohols once we make them. Okay, this other idea, when I'm talking about strong and weak, this is important because they're in the chapter as well. When we look at esters and carboxylic acids, esters with sodium borohydride have no reaction. That's partly because in an ester, the carbon has a very small partial positive, and it's a weak electrophile. It's not a very strong electrophile. It is strong enough to react with sodium borohydride or with lithium aluminum hydride. So I look at lithium aluminum hydride and then dilute acid. This will make the alcohol. Let's do it this way. Let's do R and R prime. This will make the alcohol R. And I will also get what comes off as R prime. So I get two products that come out of that. We'll look at this mechanism in a minute. So I'll go through and I'll actually do this mechanism for you because that's an important mechanism. The carboxylic acid has an important difference. It has the acidic proton. And because the proton is acidic, it reacts in a slightly different way. Sodium borohydride, oh, this also has a really small partial positive. Sodium borohydride does react with this, but not in the way that we might have expected. It reacts to form the anion in an acid-base reaction. Plus, it makes hydrogen gas. So this is really acid-base. The lithium aluminum hydride also reacts with it as an acid-base. And so initially, it also makes this. But then it can reduce even that alkoxide or the carboxylate. It can also reduce the carboxylate. And so the carboxylate gets reduced down into the alcohol. And it can still reduce it, even in its carboxylate form. So I said that I wanted to show this mechanism of how the lithium aluminum hydride reduces this. And it's because that mechanism is something that we'll see quite frequently with these types of molecules. What happens is the hydride attacks the partial positive. And the aluminum then goes to being trigonal planar for the moment. We'll come back to that. The molecule has gone from sp2 to sp3. And we call this a tetrahedral intermediate. The lone pairs exert a fairly large pressure on this molecule, and there's a built-in leaving group. That leaving group gets kicked out by the regeneration of the carbonyl. And it goes to making an aldehyde. And we get the loss of the alcohol portion of the molecule. Now, the partial positive on an ester is tiny. But the partial positive on an aldehyde is big. The aldehyde is more reactive than the ester by orders of magnitude. What that means is there's no way to stop this reaction from going forward and proceeding with more aluminum hydride. And so this guy just continues to reduce. Until it reduces all the way down, and two hydrides have been added to it. And then we take and we add the dilute acid. And at that stage, we've reduced it down to the two alcohols. But it's this idea of that when a carbonyl opens up, and there's a leaving group attached to it, the carbonyl will always close back up, ejecting it and reform. And this is a reactivity that we will see over and over again as we go through and we go forward looking at these different reactions. Okay, so, we'll get 2 minutes. Yes, let's do this. So everything I've just done has been linear, but we need to open our minds to nonlinear possibilities. What happens if I reduce this? Take the pattern that we've been doing. And think about how we can reduce this. So when we reduce an ester, the way that I think about these types of problems is that if I reduce an ester and I have R and R prime, and we do one lithium aluminum hydride and two dilute acid, we just showed that we make two different alcohols. We make the alcohol that is attached to the R and the alcohol that is attached to the R prime. And it kicks out both pieces. So essentially what it's doing is it's breaking the ester bond and it's breaking the carbonyl. Take those and attach those so that R and R prime are attached. And then when it breaks, R and R prime are still attached. So when you break this, they're still attached. And what you create, if you're careful in the way that you draw it so that you don't turn anything around. You get that, which is equal to, if we number it out, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, and 4. Oops. And then we need to put the last groups in there. In a straight chain sense, you end up with a 1,4-diol. in this case, but we end up with diols. So this, by the way, this is an ester. But do you know what we call it when the ester is in a ring? We give it a new name. We call it a lactone. A lactone is nothing more than a cyclic ester. And why they decided to name it something else, I have no idea, but they did. Two names for the same thing. So that's going to lead us into diols. And that's where we're going to pick up in the next lecture. So we'll pick up with diols and looking at all kinds of things that we can make diol-wise, turn into diols, all kinds of cool stuff from there. Okay. So lots of good things to come in this chapter. This is a great chapter because it starts to really give us a lot more tools to be able to go into synthesis. And many of these diols will be review reactions as well, because if you think about all the reactions that you had that were diol-forming reactions, you had ways of reacting with osmium tetraoxide, you had ways with potassium permanganate, you had SN2 reactions with epoxides and hydroxyl groups and all kinds of things that we will go back over some review of some of the things that we've already learned. So lots to come back into this. All right, I'm gonna cut the lecture there. I'm gonna let you go. I'll stay on the line if there's any questions. And for those people in the afternoon lab, I'll see you guys in a little bit. And I'll send out the link for the first video. I have it on YouTube yet. I was programming a new page on my website, but I'm not done with that programming yet. So as soon as I am, I'll send out the link for that. But I think I'll send out the YouTube link before then. And other than that, I'm gonna stop the recording and I'll open it up for questions.